Okay. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. "Unless you people see a miraculous signs and wonders," Jesus told him, "you will never believe." The royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus replied, "You may go. Your son will live." The man took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that the boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, "The fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour." Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." So he and all his household believed. This was the second miraculous sign that Jesus performed, having come from Judea to Galilee. And I'd just like to spend some time praying and thinking about all the people that have had such difficulty with the storm, with Matt.
And welcome to Community Bible Church. As we're getting started this morning, they gave me the microphone, so I wanted to give a little prolonged announcement on something that's very important to me, and that is Man Camp. So I know some people, or I suspect some people, might not want to ask me about Man Camp, because if you show any sort of interest in something, then people might be like, "Oh, so you're coming, right? You're coming, right?" So I just want to give you a little more information, kind of low cost, like little information exchange. And then if you find out you do want more information, then you can come to me, and then I'll be like, "Are you going to come, right?" Okay, so it's about 3 hours away, and it's not too far, but it's far enough. I don't know. It's about 3 hours away up in New Hampshire. We're going this weekend this year. And I want to give you an idea of the typical schedule. On Fridays, we usually meet here in the afternoon, and we all ride up together. It's about a three-hour drive. Dave makes it in about 2.5. So we get there by 6 o'clock. We arrive. We check in. And we sign up for workshops. So it's a lot of fun that we eat well and have fun together. But we also do these workshops. We have dinner. And then there's this opening main session. And every year, I used to look at who the speaker was going to be. And read about the speaker, and then I just said, you know what, they're always awesome, they're always great, so you know, whoever the speaker is this year, I don't even remember, but I'm sure it'll be great, and then we eat more and do whatever. And there's the main sessions. The main sessions are completely fantastic. There's a speaker that comes in for the weekend, there's four main sessions, and, wow, it's totally blurred out there, but there's over 200 people in this auditorium. We actually convert the gymnasium to a bunch of chairs, and we set up. And you only see a few people in front of me there because Dave always has us sitting up in the front. But you don't have to sit up front. You can sit in the back. And there's a praise band. And then Saturday morning, breakfast, we have another main session. Then there's this chunk of time, about 4 hours, where we have these different activities. And that's what everyone kind of thinks about with Man Camp, are the activities. And sure, they're a lot of fun. And we do things like, I'm sorry, these pictures are not showing up as great as I had hoped, but there's Dave Jolin's head. He's yanking Jay Harris. He's up in the trees there. He's up there. Jay is up there in the trees. And he's still up there. It's this giant swing. So then he yanks the chain and he swings down, and it's more fun for us watching, I think. So there he is. He's dangling, and it's a lot of fun. So these are some of the activities we do during this kind of free time during the afternoon for a few hours. But you can do, there's a whole bunch of things during this session, during this four-hour period. And I kind of rank this from, like, there's high activity level things. You can play flag football, high ropes course, whatever, and then kind of lower activity things. So if you're thinking, gosh, you know, I don't want to go break my knee that weekend, I'm not going to go. You don't have to. There's low activity things you can do, like a bocce tournament. And a Oh, it got cut. Yeah, okay, so it's there, right? The bottom one. You can even go take a nap. So it's up to you. And I don't know what this guy, I can't promise that'll be there this year, but last year there was a little hoverboard thing that ran on a leaf blower that you could ride around. So you never know what's going to be there. And the sessions, the breakout sessions, are completely awesome. Various topics related to how we as men go about living our lives as co-workers, as fathers, as husbands, in the marketplace. So all these topics are things that come up during our sessions. And the main speaker, he's talking to 200 men in the room. So it's really a message that's geared towards us as men. So who goes? We usually have a nice appropriate group, a nice group that goes. These are, and I want to point out a couple of the guys on here. Two of them said very encouraging things to me before I came up here this morning from this picture, and a third one made fun of me, and that was his way of encouraging me. So, you know, these are guys that we connect with over the course of the year. Sunday morning, right, we eat breakfast, another main session, and then we come back to campus, or come back to CBC. So who is this for? This is, if you're a man, maybe about 16 years or older, come. There's no upper age limit. If you have a man, please send him with your blessing. This really is a great time for men for the weekend, and various things to bring. So the sleeping accommodations are not fantastic. It is a camp, but it's still fun. And part of that time that we're relating is while we're complaining about the noises each other are making while we're trying to sleep or whatever. But, you know, that, feel free to ask me. Actually, since, again, they gave me the microphone, does anyone have a question right now they want to ask about man camp? To all the kids, right? I'm that guy with all the kids. And I'm going to solve a mystery for some of you right now. This might be an enigma that's been in your mind for years, and now I'm going to solve it. So just maybe your experience goes like this. So after church, please stay, and we're going to go have some snacks out in the lobby. And maybe this has happened to you. You've been out in the lobby, and you're sipping your coffee, and you're having a nice conversation. You know, there's these kids careening all over the place, smack into you. Oh, no, there's a coffee down my dress or whatever. Whoa, did you see that kid? That one just ate 5 donuts. And that one's socks don't match. Where are the parents? Right? The odds are some of those are mine. You know, and maybe you think, okay, with parents like that, they probably let their kids play out in the street with fireworks. No, our kids play in the street with knives. So, but I'm that guy with all the kids. I have 6 of them. There's Jay. This is when they're sending me off to leave to, and they're saying bye at the train station. But there's Jay giving Beth, my wonderful wife, bunny ears there. He's I'm not going to do the ages because I'm going to mess them up. But there's Jay, so my wonderful wife Beth, and Liam, Lydia. Thank you, Lydia, for being right up front here. Lydia, Joel, and Josie. I love Josie's smile there, and Savannah, who keeps the tribe in line, maybe. And that's Savannah. And one of the cool things about having all these kids is we actually kind of, when we go somewhere, we bring the crowd with us. There are 8 of us, right? So this is out at the soccer fields a week or two ago, and we're watching Josie right there. She's playing soccer, and she has her own cheerleading squad there while she's playing soccer. And we did the wave and everything right there for her. So I'm that guy with the 6 kids. They're great kids. They're wonderful. My name's Dan Shustak. My wife Beth and I, we've been members here about 8 years. And in parent years, that's like 48 years. So we've been here a while. I just wanted to show you a picture of them. I'm not going to ask them to stand up or anything because at home we don't give them attention or let them talk. And if we let them do that now, they wouldn't stop. So picture will have to do. So these 6 amazing kids, they're the reason I'm called the guy with all the kids. And often when people find out that I have 6 kids and that we homeschool the kids, they're kind of astonished, and they say things like, wow, you know, how do you do that? And they say things like, how do you have time for everything? How do you afford those kids? I can't imagine. We're so busy, we only have 3 kids. Well, it is... you're right. It's busy with any kids. It's busy with six kids, and I never get to everything on our list. Things go undone all the time, just all the time. I'm task-oriented, and I'm constantly frustrated, right? I live in frustration. But one of the things I really appreciate from you is the understanding that you guys express to us with the craziness of our household. And some of the things that some of you have done for us is you've given our kids rides all over the place. That's so awesome. It helps us out so much. You've given us food and meals and handing out clothes and books and other stuff. You've watched our kids, babysat our kids for an hour, for a weekend, in the middle of the night, like unscheduled times. And they're also appreciated by us, by Beth and myself and our family. And this understanding sentiment also gets manifested in the way that people perceive or deal with my shortcomings, both real and perceived, maybe, my shortcomings in behavior and commitment. And people will say things to me like this: Dan, I hate to ask you this because I know you're busy and you've got six kids, but, you know, and people will say things like that to me. Or I've been in meetings that go like, okay, so now we need volunteers to take care of this. And I'm, oh, yeah, yeah. Dan, I need volunteers, not you. You have six kids. I mean, come on, I'm looking for someone else. And it's like, okay. And I also have at times had to depend on your understanding, and words like this have also come out of my mouth. You know, I was really planning to get that done. I really meant to have that done by now, but it's just been so busy, and I just didn't get it done. You know, it's just kind of busy, and so, come on, give him a break. He's got six kids, right? Or this one also is, I've said things like this. I wanted to be there. I really wanted to be there, but Beth was at a meeting. Savannah needed to take her over here. Jay had to go over here. Lydia, I was playing with Lydia some soccer, and I was reading with Liam, and I was coloring with Josie, and I had to feed Joel. Do you know that Joel doesn't stop eating? I mean, I just couldn't get there. I'm sorry. And the reply is often like, I know, you got six kids, it's okay. And so I really appreciate that kind of understanding. And this morning, I'm going to ask for that same level of understanding. And I'm actually going to ask you to display compassion on me right now. I'm going to give you a chance to practice that. So in the next, whatever, half hour, and this is just getting so boring, and you're like, just lean over to the person next to you and say, he's got six kids, okay? That's it. So if it gets just too complicated, just, he's got six kids, it's okay. And I thought, you know, maybe we could practice that right now? I'm gonna fumble in my notes, and I just want you to lean to the person next to you and do the line that I just told you, okay? Oh, where was I? Okay. All right. Thank you guys so much for that. Thank you. So, as we get going here this morning, I just want to take a moment to pray. And then that's it. Like I said, I'm busy. That's all the material I've got today. So. So let's go ahead and pray. God, we just ask that you would just meet us here this morning, Lord. Lord, the words that I've prepared and thought about this morning, Lord, I want that to be a message from you, and anything that's just not from you, that's just junk, Lord, just let that be forgotten. And Lord, help us all to take away the peace, the truth that you want us to take away from here today. And Lord, we want to glorify you as we look into your word. Amen. So I was kidding. I actually do have a few more pages of notes here. So we're in week five of a series we're calling Face to Face. And these are all stories that we're looking at that are coming out of the Gospel of John. And so when we read the book of John, that's one of four books in the New Testament of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that are written very much in this story-like format, right? So it's written as though it's something that someone's observing and something that happened. So it's like, okay, Jesus was born, he grew up, he did this, he went over here, he talked to this person, he said this person said this back. And so it's like this matter-of-fact things that, it's like the authors actually saw it happening, or they talk to someone who saw it happening, and they're writing this stuff down, right? They're giving us little details, like who's there, what time of day is it. They're telling us who said what, who went where, even details sometimes that don't really seem to matter. And, you know, it's like the authors, they're not thinking, oh, I'm writing the Bible. They're writing what they saw, right? They're just writing down things that happened, things that people actually said. And as we read these stories, I think we should keep this in mind, right? These are not... These are not stories that were made up to make a point. It's not like, oh, I've got some great idea. Let's make up a story to illustrate that. These are stories that happened, and they do make a point. And these stories that we're focusing on in this series that we're calling Face to Face are examples of interactions that Jesus had with people around him. And specifically, these interactions that Jesus had with individuals, with one person in this face-to-face context. So and we're thinking about questions like, how did Jesus encounter these people when he was face-to-face with them? You know, when we communicate with each other, we do it differently when we're face-to-face versus any other format, right? So I think our experience, we know this. And let me give you an example, right? I'm going to tell you something you already, I think maybe you already know. When we talk on the phone, so maybe you've had a conversation like I have that goes something like this. My sister Valerie, like, yeah, we're going to be at mom's house for Thanksgiving. Oh, you're going to bring a salad. Okay, we'll bring some mashed potatoes. Oh, Joel's been sick, but he should be better by then. Flush. What? Are you in the bathroom? Was that the toilet? Oh, disgusting, right? She'll do that on the phone to me. Oh, did I just sell my sister out? That was supposed to be That actually did happen. I'm not the only one this has happened to. So out of a survey of 400 people, 44% have heard the toilet flush while on the phone with someone else. Yeah, that's disgusting, right? That's gross. I want you to look to the person to your left and look to the person to your right, okay? There are three of you there, right? Out of three of you, two of you do this. Two of you use your phone in the bathroom. Okay. That's gross, okay? If Jesus' disciples had phones, Jesus would have said there's a third greatest commandment. No phones in the bathroom, right? He would have, I'm pretty sure. One out of ten of us, one out of ten of you, 9% have dropped their phone. Do you know who doesn't have this problem? People who don't take their phone in the bathroom. That was free. I think this extremely gross example serves to illustrate the rule that we do communication differently when we're right there with someone than in any other context, right? Whether you're text messaging, on the phone, Facebook posting, yelling across the street, or in a big room like this. We do communication differently when we're right there. And as we grow, as we mature socially, we learn kind of how these different forms of communication work. And when we're face-to-face, you know, I think it's harder for us to hide our true feelings, right? It's harder to conceal our emotions. It's harder to conceal our disappointment in ourselves, the person we're talking to. You know, our body language, our nonverbal cues, and even like the wear and tear on our physical bodies kind of gives some of that away when we're face to face. And I think physical proximity of being face to face can push interactions to an extreme. We can probably look back over our lives and find examples of this. Like, is there someone who in your past, they've hurt you, right? You have this baggage with that relationship. You don't like someone very much. You think about that person, and you just get, ugh. And then what happens? Of course, you run into them, and there you are. There you are. And something just, you're mad at them, and you see them, you run into them, and you just let them have it. Maybe you've been on the other side of that, and you've gotten it. Our face-to-face interactions, they're different, right? It pushes our interactions to the extreme. Our confrontations become more confrontational. But what about the opposite extreme? Someone you really love, you really care for. In that case, a phone call, a hello from across the street, that's not going to do it, right? You want to be there. It's unsatisfying just to wave. You want to be face-to-face. You want to be right up there and enjoy that intimacy of that interaction. A close conversation, a friendly touch, a romantic embrace. I think one of the reasons face-to-face interactions can push these kind of dynamics to an extreme is that it's hard to escape when we're face-to-face with someone. It's hard to leave. You could just walk away, But if you're angry, you don't want to. You want to have it out. How hard is it to leave? If you're hurt, you might be too afraid to turn away. And if you're in love, you don't want to leave, right? So, you know, maybe you've leveraged this fact in your life to your advantage of when you're face-to-face, it's kind of hard to leave. I have many times. There's one, I'll give you one little anecdote of a story I'm going to say I'm a little proud of, because it turned out great. But so back in 2001, Beth and I were planning to get married. We're down in Texas, or we're getting married in Texas. I was up in Pennsylvania. And so in 2001, I go and buy my plane ticket to fly down to San Antonio from Philadelphia. Everything's going as planned. And then I find out, oh, my mom calls me and says, Danny, guess what? Your dad and I, we bought our plane tickets to fly to San Antonio. We're leaving the day before you. Will you drive us to the airport? What? Is that how it's? Okay, sure, Mom. Sure, Mom. It just didn't feel right. Like, they're going to my wedding before me. I knew I could have called the airline, right? I could have called and said, could I change my plane ticket? You know, I'm broke. I don't have the money to pay the change fee, the additional cost of buying it closer to the date of leaving and so on. So the day to drive my parents to the airport comes. I drive my parents to the airport. I take them over to long-term parking with me. We get out. We leave the car. We all go over to the airport, and I act like I'm going to leave that day. My plane is not leaving until the next day. I go in, my parents, I say, you know, bye, you know, they take off, and I go up to the counter, the ticket counter, I say, here I am, I'm going to San Antonio, I'm ready to go. The ticket agent says, you're a day early, Mr. Shustak. I said, that's okay, I'm going to get married, I'm ready now. She said, I'm sorry, you just have to come back tomorrow. I said, with the saddest look I could show on my face, I said, I'm going to get married. My bride, my beautiful bride, she's waiting for me. I'm going to wait right here until tomorrow. I was on the next flight out of Philadelphia. I got to San Antonio at the same time my parents did. It was great. When we're face to face, it's harder to be dismissed, right? So this is where we are. We're thinking through and thinking about these raw, intimate, personal, convicting, confrontational, face-to-face interactions that Jesus had with people like Nicodemus. Nicodemus doesn't get it. He doesn't understand who Jesus is. He meets face-to-face with Jesus, and he gets this profound theological lesson. Or Jesus meets face-to-face with this broken, hurting woman at a well. She can't hide her sin. Jesus calls her out on it. Jesus loves on her. And she goes and tells her friends all about it. Today I want to tell you a story about another face-to-face interaction from the book of John. So there's this guy, right? We don't know his name. He wasn't like the woman at the well, though. He was really different. He's a career man. He's made something of himself. He probably has people to go fetch his water for him, right? He probably's got people to do that kind of work for him. He's a pretty important guy, and he's a government official that works for Herod. And Herod's a pretty important guy in this area as well. Not only is this an important guy, he lives in the right place. He's got the waterfront property on Capernaum. And he lives on the right side of the track, so to speak. We know he's a father. We don't know how many kids he has, but we know he has at least one, right? He's got one son, at least. And that son is very sick, very sick. He's got a very high fever. We don't know what's causing the fever, but we know that fever is so high that the father and his whole family, his family is worried this boy's going to die. That's how sick this kid is. And the father's desperate. And despite all of his means, all of his power, his position, his wealth, he can't do anything. He can't do anything. He's run out of options. But wait, he's heard something. He's heard about this guy who's doing stuff down in Jerusalem, doing these signs and things. This guy named Jesus coming out of Nazareth. Like, oh, yeah, he's heard. This news has gotten around the region, right? He's heard about these things, this miracle worker guy. The news is passing around the region. Maybe it goes something like this. Maybe the royal official, he's at work, and he hears his guy saying, oh, hey, did you hear about that guy? He was down in Jerusalem. He's coming north. Yeah, he's doing all this stuff, and he's coming north, you know? I heard he's supposed to be in Cana tomorrow. And the father's like, miracle worker coming to Cana. Cana, that's about 15, 20 miles from where he lives. And he gets this idea. Maybe Jesus, maybe the sign-doer guy can do something for my son. Just maybe. Maybe if I go to Jesus, I can get him to come with me and heal my son. So the father takes off for Capernaum, from Capernaum, goes about the 15 or 20 miles to Cana. We don't know how he got there, right? Maybe he walked. Maybe someone carried him. Maybe he had a horse. He probably had a horse, you know, probably had a horse. But it took him a couple hours. And I can kind of imagine on his way, he's thinking through, okay, I'm going to go meet this guy. I've never seen him before. He doesn't know me. I got this sick kid. Like, he's thinking in his mind, what am I going to say when I get there? He's kind of practicing that. You know what I mean? You're practicing. You're getting ready for when you're there, when you're on the spot. He gets to Jesus, and he lets his desperation out. I want you to think about this for a second. He went himself, right? He left his dying kid. And that 20 miles, for all he knows, his kid's going to be dead before. He doesn't know. But he doesn't want to risk the rejection of sending a message or a messenger. He goes himself to see Jesus and leverage that face-to-face interaction with Jesus. He gets to Jesus, and I kind of imagine in my mind, the text doesn't say this, you know, he's practiced this speech, and he gets to Jesus, and it's like, or whatever I practice, whatever, like, Jesus, please. Just the desperation drips off of him. My son is sick. He is so, so sick. He's about to die. Please, Jesus, please, you must come with me to Capernaum and heal my son. The text says Jesus implored. The text says the father implored Jesus to go with him to heal his son. The father begged Jesus to come. Jesus, please, just come with me. You're the only hope I have for my son. Royal official, important guy. He's probably used to telling people what to do. And he's probably not used to people saying no to him, right? This is probably a guy who gets what he says. He doesn't order to Jesus come, but he begs him. He begs him, Jesus, please come. Come with me to Capernaum. Come to my house. So Jesus is there. He feels this intensity, this emotion, the desperation of the father who's right there, right in front of him. And Jesus responds to the father, right? I think he's right there. I think he asked to say something. He's right there in Jesus' face, and Jesus says, you won't believe unless you see signs. So, right, the man's pleading, and he gets this apparently unrelated comment, seemingly scolding this poor father of the dying son for his request. But the man's undeterred. Doesn't matter. He's focused on one thing. He's not arguing with Jesus. He's not making excuses. Well, yes, yeah, but, yeah. He stays on his primary purpose. The father said on one thing, just one thing, his dying son. He's face to face with Jesus, and he begs Jesus again. Jesus, sir, Lord, come with me and heal my son. The man says to Jesus, come. And Jesus says to the man, go. Jesus says to the father of the dying boy, go, your son lives. It's like Jesus is saying, I'm not going with you, but you go. Your son, he's already better. The father doesn't get Jesus to come with him. But Jesus does declare that the boy is well. The father believes Jesus. He believes Jesus' words. And the man goes home to his son who's all better. And I think the sequence of the events here is really interesting. Because Jesus declares the boy is well. Then we find out the father believed Jesus. The father believes Jesus before he knows what actually happened. Right? He doesn't know what's happened. He doesn't see the proof of his healed son who's still 20 miles away. He won't see his son till the next day. But he believes Jesus. The father lives and he acts in this belief. He lives and acts in this tension. He believes and he acts like what Jesus said is true, that his son really is well. He acts like this is true before he has any proof. Before he has proof that his son's healed, before he has proof that Jesus is good on his word, right? Jesus says, go, your son is well. The man believes and he goes. The father believed Jesus, and the father took this first step even before he had all the answers, even before he knew how this story would end. The face-to-face interaction with Jesus and this royal official with a dying son, I think it shows us that the first step of obedience does not require knowing everything about God or even having complete faith. We can still take the first step. I want to put John, here's John 4:50. Here's the verse we're hanging on here. Jesus said to him, "Go, your son lives." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he started off. So in this face-to-face interaction with Jesus, this important, powerful government official, this career man, father, man of means, he comes to Jesus out of desperation. I think, as a parent myself, I think this kind of desperation for your child is probably more severe than a form of desperation you would feel for yourself. And it's this desperation that the man comes and he thinks he knows how Jesus works. He thinks he knows how Jesus can do this, right? He believes enough in Jesus to leave his dying son, go to Jesus and beg Jesus for help, to implore Jesus, "Come to my house and heal my son." And Jesus is like, "Great plan, Dad. Good thinking. I'm glad you're here to tell me how to do my God thing. I'm glad you came up with the plan. Let's go do your plan." Right? I don't think Jesus needs to be told how to be God. Instead, Jesus gives the father of the dying boy one simple action step, right? It's one simple thing. He says, "Go. Go." Jesus doesn't give the father all the answers. He doesn't give any other explanation to how this is all going to happen. The father doesn't need to know the process that Jesus is going to use to work here. The man needed to do one step of obedience. Go. That's what Jesus tells him to do. He doesn't need complete, mature faith. It doesn't question anything. In fact, when we read the rest of the story, we find out that he goes home. He gets home the next day, and he finds his son as well. Great. And he says, hey, servant, when did my son get better exactly? And the servant says, "Yesterday at 1 o'clock. And the man's like, "Ha ha, I knew it. Jesus did it." Right? He has enough faith to ask Jesus, and he believed. But he wanted to understand even more, and he went home and he asked, "What happened here?" He took a step of obedience before his faith was complete, and when Jesus said go, the man did it. He did it. You know, I see myself in this guy. Right? We're separated by 2,000 years. The details of our lives are different. I have a car, he's got a chariot or a horse or whatever. Credit cards, he's got, I don't know, gold coins or copper or what, I don't know. I like to wear sneakers, he wore sandals, I'm pretty sure he didn't have Nike sneakers. You know, the details are different, but when we're going about our lives, we experience and feel a lot of the same things, don't we? Frustration, desperation, pain, we hurt, we love. Right now, you might not have a dying child, but have you called to God out of a moment of desperation? I have. Have you called to God and tried to tell God how he should act, how he should be God? "This is what you can do for me, God." I've said it. Here's an example. I'm living my life. Things are great. My wife says something to me. She doesn't say something to me. She does something. She doesn't do something. She fails to meet my expectations, and I pray about it, right? Just like that royal official. He's speaking to Jesus. He's praying to him. He's right there. I'm praying to him, and I speak to Jesus, and I pray, "Oh, Lord, please soften my wife's heart and help her understand how she's hurting me and letting me down. And Jesus, when you do that in her life, that will allow me to be the husband you want me to be, right? I can really love her back. I can say these things to God, and I tell him what he needs to do with my wife and all the ways she needs to change. And I give God all my great ideas, right? This is what you can do." And I ignore what God's already said, right? He's already said it. Maybe it's a problem at work. I look around at my coworkers, and I see them not working as hard as I think they should. "How long have you been working on your Facebook update over there? You came in at 10 o'clock. Hey, didn't you leave at 3 o'clock yesterday, too? You're not on any committees this year, are you?" This one, we don't even need to pray about this, right? You know, we know what to do in this case. We want to match the pace of the workplace, right? I don't want to ruffle any feathers. I'm just going to fit in. I'm going to set the cruise control. Now, what does Jesus say? He says, go. Whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. Go. Or how about this example? Things feel tight financially, but I really want another, fill in the blank, car, boat, house, TV, refrigerator, furniture, phone, clothes, shoes, vacation. I mean, I've got one or two or three or four that already work. They're okay, but they could all break at any time, right? Look at it. It's feeling kind of old, worn out. Oh, dear God, it would help me relate to my friends, my coworkers and classmates and neighbors if I had a new. Oh, please give me a new. I could really use it. Not only would it make my life better, but if I get a new one, God, you would see that I could do more things for you. People would look at Christians and say, look how God blesses them. I'd be more able to effectively minister to the people in my life. And what, right? Come on. You're laughing because it's. Jesus says, go. He says, do not store up treasures on earth, but store up treasures in heaven. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Man, I'm complicating things, right? I can keep going. I mean, my life's messed up. I got stuff I deal with, you know. These are not facetious examples of, you know. Like you, I'm pretty good at dressing these things up and making it look good, you know. You might use different words. You might say it differently than I do. All right, how about one more? How about, God, you bless me so much in such tangible ways. Thank you for a job and a house and a car. But I would feel so much more peace in my life if there were another $100 in my bank account. If there were another $2,000 in my bank account, I would really feel your peace. If there were another $100,000 in my retirement account, if I had a retirement account, I could just feel your peace. I'm not asking for a lot, right? I mean, look at them. I'm not asking for that, but look at them. Look how content and peaceful they are. I just want that financial security so my family and I can be content and we don't have to worry and we can trust you more. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. So I don't know what it is for you. I don't know. You know, I don't think our experiences are all that different. What are you struggling with? What's it you're asking? And I don't think we should point the finger somewhere else. I think he's called us to make a move, right? Just make a move, a small step. He told that royal official, go. And the man turned around, he went. When you come to Jesus, when you pray to him, do you try to tell God how to be God? You see what the royal official did? He wanted Jesus to come. Jesus said, go. I think in this story, we see that God's communicating to us, you know, you already know the first step, don't you? Like, we know. Go and do it. And just like that royal official, father of a dying son, we don't need to know how it's all going to turn out. We don't need to have all the answers before we take the first step. So I don't know, what is it today? What is it in your life where you, where I need to take that first step? The story of the royal official and his dying son shows us that the first step of obedience does not require complete faith. This story shows us we can't hide behind the lack of faith as an excuse for not doing what we know we should do. The father with the dying son obeyed one simple command, and his faith grew more. Will God do the same thing for us today? What would it look like in our lives if when we cried out to God, we didn't plead and beg that God does the things the way we think he should, but instead we told him, yeah, tell him all your worries, cast all your cares on him, don't leave anything out, but then we take our first step of obedience, and we do it. And I think for many of us, in most cases, our problem is not knowing what that first step is. I don't think that's it in most cases. Our problem is not knowing enough Bible verses, right? That's not our problem. I don't think it is. I think what I put up there is probably familiar to most of us in here. I think our problem is actually doing the ones we know, right? So what would it look like in our lives if we acted out of the faith we do have? What would it look like in our families, in our church? What would it look like each day, every day, one decision at a time, if we just take that first step out of obedience? Acting out of the faith we have, no matter how small, that God's already given us. Over the past few weeks that I've been thinking, praying, studying this text, preparing this message, there's this song, right, that's popped in my head, and this probably happens to you, you know what I mean? You get this idea, and then, bing, there's this song, and just... And I was just thinking of this story and what this royal official did. This man, out of desperation, finds Jesus, comes to him face-to-face with Jesus, and Jesus gives the man a simple, simple direction. Go. Your son lives. And the man believed Jesus. Sometimes we can substitute, right, belief. He trusted. He trusted Jesus. And the man went. The man obeyed Jesus. He trusted and obeyed. Trust and obey. Would you pray with me this morning? Lord, we thank you for bringing us this text this morning from John 4. Lord, I know there's at least one person in the room this text is spoken to because he's standing right here, but maybe there are others, Lord. And Lord, I want you to show us what those, that one step, Lord, what is it we're struggling with and we're just, oh, God, I don't know how to turn, I can't do, and we feel paralyzed because we don't know all the answers. The Lord helps to take the first step this week, today, in obeying you, Lord, and we trust through that we would come to know you more and that our faith in you would grow through that obedience. Amen.